Hey guys, and welcome to the fifth underrated minisode. I'm your host, Gabriel Green, and I'm here with my co-host, James Hamrick. How you doing, man?
Doing all right. Feeling a little under the weather, but should be good.
All right, so we do these minisodes so we can get into the fun of reviewing new releases or films that don't exactly fit into our underrated mold. And actually, we're supposed to be reviewing Reign of Fire this week, and we actually did. But for some unknown reason, the recording program decided to just eat the files for our guest. So we will be have to reschedule that and re-record it all, but we did do it. It was a pretty disastrous recording, so I'm almost a little glad that it got lost so I don't have to edit it.
Yeah, it was kind of ironic that it ended up not recording on the same episode in which my internet cuts in and out, and I drop in and out of the conversation inexplicably, and there's a 10-second delay. Like you said, like it's sad that we have to ask Aaron to come back on again for the same movie, but you know, I think the episode will be better for it.
Yeah. All right, so we're definitely gonna get back to that. We will discuss Batman v Dragons eventually, but today instead we are looking at the latest film from the controversial director M. Night Shyamalan, Split. So let's get right into it. Split was directed by M. Night Shyamalan on a budget of $9 million, and so far has grossed $55 million. That number's actually a couple days old, so it's probably even higher by now. It's Shyamalan's second collaboration with Blumhouse Productions, which is a fascinating little company. It's like they produce all kinds of like low-budget films, mostly horror, and they're usually around $3 to $5 million, and they all generally make a huge profit, some like into the hundreds of millions. And while I think a lot of the films they produce aren't very good, I think it is cool they kind of giving directors like Shyamalan a chance for kind of redemption in a way.
Yeah, I mean, you can't argue with it. Those are some profits that they're making.
Seriously. Yeah, like a lot of small-time directors getting their start there, too. It's really cool. The film stars Anya Taylor-Joy, James McAvoy, Betty Buckley, Haley Lou Richardson, and Jessica Sulu. It was shot by Mike Giaukalis, I think. And the score was composed by Wes Dillon. And I'll get you to read the brief synopsis, James.
All right, so three girls are kidnapped by a man with diagnosed 23 distinct personalities and must try and escape before the apparent emergence of a frightful new 24th.
All right. So this is going to be a spoiler-filled review. If you haven't seen the film yet, please do yourself a favor and go watch it. It's definitely worth seeing, unsullied by spoilers.
Yeah. I mean, on any movie with, you know, any sort of twist or anything unexpected towards the end, I would already say, you know, please just go ahead and wait to watch it. But especially with this movie, like, I almost beg of you, do not look up any spoilers and please avoid this episode, because this is a movie worth seeing, you know, with as blindly as you can.
Yeah, definitely. All right, this film is kind of being praised as Shyamalan's return to form. Do you agree with that?
I think so. I think that that this proves that he does best on a lower budget and just kind of, you know, a tighter, smaller film. When he tries to get too big with things like After Earth or The Happening or The Last Airbender, it just doesn't do well. And he's acknowledged it in interviews. And so I think that it's him returning to what he does best, and this proves that he still understands his craft, because this is a well-made film.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think The Visit, either last year before or year before that, it did mark a return to his traditional sensibilities and just the quality of filmmaking that we expected from him, from seeing films like Sixth Sense, Unbreakable, or Signs. And I think this having a second film that's even better than The Visit, I think is kind of a confirmation that he still has the chops, that just the raw filmmaking talent that made us all love him in the first place. What are some things you liked about this film?
Well, first of all, I think that it has, for the most part, a pretty strong cast. Well, obviously, I'll talk about McAvoy, but just to highlight some of the other cast, Betty Buckley is really good here. She is essentially tasked with giving us most of the explanation and exposition as to, you know, who Kevin, which is James McAvoy's character, who he is and the way the personalities work. She essentially sets up the rules of this movie and the rules that the personalities adhere to. You know, this means this. And I think it could have been really easy for this to just really come off as cheesy, but I think she gives a really good performance, and I believe that she believes that this is actually what Kevin's suffering from, and this is a real thing, and that she cares about all these patients, and I ended up becoming really invested in her character as the movie went on.
Yeah, that character could have so easily been just kind of a one-note exposition machine, and she brought a lot of heart to it, and even like some flaws. You see, where she is so obsessed with trying to find out what's going on and pushing the limits of the science, that you see she might actually not be the most responsible person, and you almost question her motivations. Well, I definitely think she was obviously very caring for Kevin. Some of the things she does and things she allows to happen are kind of questionable. And I think she does it. She thinks she is doing what's best for these people, but you kind of got to wonder about some of her judgment in the end. But even so, she comes off just as a very warm and sympathetic person.
Yeah. Even when she is making the mistakes that you mentioned, you're wishing that she didn't, because you don't want anything to happen to her, you know, and you really come to like her. And I don't know, overall it was like what you said, just something warm about her character. Like, she felt like a real human being who cared about somebody, which in turn makes the audience care.
Mm-hmm. And I guess we should obviously talk about James McAvoy. Ah. Man, it's insane, his performance in this film. He plays about a half dozen characters that we see. We see a couple more in like brief videos, but it's amazing. What's amazing is that as we watch the film, we get to know each one of the three main characters he plays as. And you can, before he even talks, you can tell who it is just by their body language and how he holds his face. It's just so good. And they're all distinct, and each one has their own personality. I think my favorite is Hedwig, the 9-year-old boy. And that performance is insane, because it's not just how he talks in his face. Every bit of his body language is that of a child. Just how he carries himself, just kind of the lightness of how he moves. Just kind of how slow he is on the uptake in certain conversations. I forget I'm watching a 40-year-old man or whatever, 35-year-old man. And I think I'm watching a child. It's so good.
Yeah. This is probably my personal favorite performance from James McAvoy. It's just one of the most entertaining performances, really, from any actor, to just sit down and watch. Every scene with him in it is a joy to watch. It's so good. Whether he's playing the fashion designer Barry in the in his meetings with Betty Buckley's character, his psychiatrist, who's this very polite and funny man who's obsessed with, you know, what everyone's wearing, and or playing, you know, Hedwig, like you said, this 9-year-old character who's so easily manipulated but very sympathetic to Dennis, who's kind of the muscle and suffers from OCD. Every single character, every personality in this is so distinct from each other, not just in voice. It's not just him doing, you know, different vocal impressions. It is, like you said, it's his body language. It's his entire demeanor changes from one character to the next. it honestly feels like we should refer to each personality as its own distinct performance. Like, he's giving multiple performances as an actor in this movie, and he pours himself into every single one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my favorite parts are where he does it in a single take. I think that my two favorite scenes, well, I have a couple, but the scenes where he's with Betty Buckley. What's the doctor's name? I forget. Dr.
Fletcher?
Fletcher, yeah. And she's just pressing him the first time she does it, and he doesn't admit that he's actually Dennis disguised as Barry. But when she finally does it, and you just kind of see the facade slowly fading, and then in a single take, he just kind of moves his head over a little bit, and he's instantly Dennis again. And then I love, once we actually see Barry, it's a subtler performance, and we realize that he was actually kind of hamming it up in his, as Dennis was acting as Barry, he was kind of exaggerating all of his kind of personality traits.
Yeah, it's weird how he can ascend, like he's playing one person pretending to be another person. And it doesn't feel like this is James McAvoy pretending to be this person. It feels like this is James McAvoy pretending to be this person, pretending to be this person. Like, the way he keeps track of everything in his own mind is really impressive. And I don't know if he's going to get the nomination for it just because it's a January release. But I hope that, you know, with just the idea that he's playing so many personalities and it's a part of what's being called by many to be Shyamalan's comeback, I hope it's memorable enough to keep in the back of the mind of a lot of the people at the Academy, but I hope he ends up getting nominated because this is just such an engaging and entertaining and well-done performance all around.
Yeah, I hope so, because last film about a crazy guy who kidnaps a girl in his basement didn't get a nomination, even though he really deserved it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I've always loved James McAvoy ever since I saw him as Mr. Tumnus in the Chronicles of Narnia. And then now as Professor X, he's such a great actor. He doesn't get the credit he deserves.
No, he is amazing.
All right, that brings us to Anya Taylor-Joy. Oh, she is incredible. She starts out as a very kind of quiet, almost slightly unlikable character. Who she's like the least affected by the fact that she's been kidnapped, and you're kind of agreeing with the other girls that they got to do something and get out. But she's, as you learn later on in the film, she has her reasons for why she doesn't want to fight back. Especially as the film goes on and you see how she tries to begin manipulating characters like Hedwig, her performance is insane. It's like, she's like magnetic. There's a lot of times where she's just simply, the camera's just on her face and she's not even saying anything, but you cannot look away because there's so much going on in her expressions. I mean, this performance is incredible.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's very possible that this performance is going to get overlooked just because of, you know, James McAvoy and the fact that he's doing all these out there things, and he's amazing, obviously, but I agree, she is really, really good in this. You know, in a lot of movies, when the camera just lingers on someone's face, it almost begins to get awkward after a certain amount of time. But in this, like, you know, it's partly due to just, you know, what's going on in the scene. But it never feels like a shot is held on for too long just because of the way she's able to emote using just her facial expressions. Like, we are understanding this character's thought process and what's going on in her head, whether she's terrified, whether she's confused or thinking about something. It's always clearly conveyed in her face in a very realistic manner. And it's, I think, a much more, you know, subtle performance than others, but it's still easily just as good.
Yeah. And that trick of like focusing on someone's face is something that Shyamalan often uses. And he kind of uses it in place of jump scares when something as scary is happening. Instead of just like spiking the music and flashing the camera to something else, he just lets the camera stay on the person's face and we watch the fear in their eyes. And we get scared because we're just like existing in their fear because we don't know exactly what they're seeing. We're only getting information through their eyes, through the fear we hear, with the fear we see in their face. And I think it's much more effective, and it just makes for a much creepier and more tense tone than just constantly releasing tension through jump scares.
Yeah, just speaking about the camera work, the camera work in this movie, the cinematography, it is very, very good. I forget the name of the cinematographer, and I might as well not try to pronounce it. I don't think I'd be able to either. But
yeah, let's just call him Mike.
Yeah, there we go. Mike's really good.
Yeah.
But he just came off of It Follows. I haven't actually seen that. I've heard a lot of good things, and I heard that the cinematography in that movie is good as well, but in this, he is really able to use it effectively. Whether it's just focusing in on a character and really not doing anything else but just allowing us to soak up what's going on in that scene, or there's some really great shots of just like really cool symmetry in certain scenes. But overall, anytime we're in the basement, it just gives us this sense of claustrophobia. It feels very invasive sometimes and overtly in your face. And there's just something about it, especially, like I said, in the scenes where with the girls who are locked up, that just, it makes you feel like you are in these close quarter environment, just where he decides to place the camera. And then there's some actually, like, there's some pretty good transitions and just overall dynamic camera going on in scenes with Betty Buckley's character. And obviously, there's not really as much to do with a camera out there to evoke certain tones, but overall, it's just, there's a lot of good stuff going on in this movie.
Yeah, and what's amazing about the sense of claustrophobia and dread is that, unlike a film like 10 Cloverfield Lane or a lot of other confined pictures, is he doesn't even try to keep the perspective only in the space of in the confined space. We leave it multiple times into a very comfortable looking sitting room and just the outside. But we still, every time we come back, we're instantly brought back into the dread and claustrophobia of this basement, even though we leave it quite a few times. It is really skillful.
It almost feels like, you know, he's filming the film in different ways, whether he's outside or inside. He's not using the same techniques. And so I think just highlighting the contrast is almost what helps us feel even more kind of closed in. Because if this is how the movie was the whole time, we're just thinking, oh, this is just how the movie is shot. But when we go outside and we feel like, okay, this is more comfortable, it's that much more jarring when we go back into the basement and it just feels that much closer, like almost too close. And just the way he films it is very different between the two areas. And I mean, obviously, I think that was very intentional, and I think it was very effective.
Yeah. I don't have a lot to say about the other two girls, Haley Lou Richardson and Jessica Sula. They're fine. I think Haley Lou Richardson was overacting just a bit, especially compared to, like, Anya Taylor-Joy's very toned-down performance. So I think she stood out just a little bit. She wasn't bad, but she was, like, in a slightly more heightened version of this film. But what I did like is that they aren't stupid. The girls aren't stupid. They make dumb decisions sometimes, but that's just because they're under pressure. But generally, they're fairly smart, and they are trying to work together to get out of the situation. And it was definitely refreshing not to have them just portrayed as idiots.
Yeah, I wouldn't call her performance overall over the top, but I do think that there were a couple of moments where it was, like you said, heightened to an extent that the movie itself wasn't at that moment. So I think there were moments where she overacted a little bit, and then it's kind of funny. I have the opposite complaint with Sula. I think there were moments where she kind of underacted. It seemed like she was just kind of there in some moments, like, well, you know, I guess is it. Like, it's just, there was something about it where, even though Anya Taylor-Joy's character wasn't, you know, freaking out, she was still, like, you could look at her and you could tell, like, she understands the severity of what's going on. Whereas there were some moments with Sula's character where it just seemed like she was just kind of there and not really doing anything. But like with Richardson's performance, I don't think it was the entire performance. I just think there were a couple of moments where it didn't really feel believable. But overall, like you said, they're not idiots. They're not tripping over themselves. They're not doing unrealistic things. They're not doing anything that any of us probably wouldn't have done in that situation. Every opportunity, every chance they're given that they take in realistic ways. So I think it helped the movie to feel more realistic. Like, these are actual people who are just trying to get out.
Yeah, they're not bad. And I think, like, especially Richardson, she would have probably been the standout character in a different horror film. It's just the kind of outclassed here just by how good the other two are.
Yeah, and one of the things that I liked a lot about this movie was its music and its use of it. And really just it the movie's sound design overall. I remember after the opening scenes taking place and the credits start going, the multiple words as they, like, you know, it'll say directed by Shyamalan, but it says it like 23 times across the screen. And then you kind of hear that, the weird music as it overplays. It really did a good job of setting the tone from just the opening credits going forward. But what this movie does with its music is it's gone for so long of a portion of this movie. And then whenever the tension starts to rise, you hear that piano slowly creep in before you even realize there's a musical score going on now. But it's so subtle in the way it enters scenes that by the time you realize that you're on the edge of your seat, you're hearing a full score at this point. And it's just done so well. And I thought that, you know, when you combine that kind of music with the cinematography and the performance, it just all comes together to create some of the best scenes of tension I've seen.
Yeah, it's a very subtle atmospheric score for most of the time. I may have missed it, but I don't remember any like standout tracks, but it all comes together in this, like, with the cinematography and the acting to make this just cohesive, creepy whole.
Yeah, it really just sounds like we're reiterating some of the things we said about Signs, but there are moments where just every different aspect of filmmaking comes together in certain moments of this movie that just makes it feel so unified and well done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. After I saw this split, I went back and wanted to finally catch up with some of the Shyamalan films I hadn't seen. So I went and saw Lady in the Water. I don't know how this was the same filmmaker, the guy who made Signs in this film. And just I don't know how he can turn around and make such a limp movie with no tension almost no acting ability from great actors. I don't know. It's just weird.
Yeah,
he's a mystery.
He himself is a mystery. And then lastly for me, the thing that I really enjoyed, and this actually went from something I disliked to something I liked a lot because of what is revealed in the movie, but it's James McAvoy as the Horde, which is what he ends up getting called. Whenever the Beast finally shows up, honestly, I wasn't into it in the theater at first. Especially whenever we started to see his, like, just bulging veins, it just became way too unbelievable for me. I mean, the movie wasn't like this incredibly realistic psychological horror before this. I'm sure that psychiatrists could watch this and be like, yeah, that's not how personalities work at all. But as an audience member who doesn't know anything about that, I'm all on board to buy into what the movie has been telling us up to that point. And so when McAvoy shows up running as fast as he does and then climbing on the wall and taking shotgun blasts point blank, I was enjoying it, kind of, but I was watching it with kind of a sense of disappointment in the back of my mind. But then the ending happens and you find out that this is taking place in the same universe as Unbreakable. And then all is forgiven in
what?
My mind.
That's what that was. Okay.
Yeah, there was a lot of that in my audience. I just want to applaud the producer, everybody who signed off on making this happen, because you have just had the twist of your movie essentially rely on people having seen and remembering a 17-year-old film. Like, that's...
Yeah.
That's gutsy. It takes a lot of guts to give a director an okay to have his big reveal be something that could, and in my case, for a lot of the people in the audience, did get lost on a lot of people. For mm-hmm. every person who gasped, there was also somebody who was scratching their head.
Yeah, I had to explain it to some people who were sitting next to me in the theater. But it was so awesome when Bruce Willis showed up and said, they called him Mr. Glass. And then half the theater's like, oh my gosh. And then, yeah, the other half's like, what? But it's, and I was just like sitting in my seat, because I was the same as you. As he was turning into the Beast, I was like, oh, we're going there? Okay, come on, don't do that. You were so good up till now. This is getting goofy, ridiculous. And it was fine, because the filmmaking was so good that I was like, okay, whatever. But I'm taking a couple stars off for this kind of thing. And then how it ended, I like the resolution of Casey and the Beast's conflict. And then, so I kind of was forgiving a bit more. And then when he showed up, I was like, oh, so this is that kind of movie. Okay, I don't care anymore that it's unrealistic. Of course it's unrealistic. This is a world of superheroes and supervillains. So who cares if it's unrealistic? It changes the genre of the film. While it's still a good thriller up till then, this allows me to forgive all of the reservations I had for it up till now by putting it in a genre that allows these kind of things. It's so brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, once you realize that this entire movie was essentially an origin story for a supervillain, every outlandish thing makes sense. Every time he does something completely ridiculous, you are instantly reminded of the ridiculous things that any other comic book villain has done, and you're like, this makes sense. This works. And so, rethinking about all of the moments of the Beast with that in mind, I end up really liking the finale. Specifically, the part where he has Anya Taylor-Joy's character back behind the bars, and he just starts bending them with his sheer strength and putting his bloodied face between them. It was like almost a sense of terror that few films have offered recently. And it's not a jump scare. It's not... It's nothing but performance. It's nothing but James McAvoy's face taking up about 3/4 of the entire screen with this psychotic look on his face and blood pouring out of his teeth. And it is really... really creepy. And so just with that whole twist in mind, looking back on the final act, it really changed how I viewed that and the whole movie.
Yeah. I guess my only criticism about that scene is that I wish McAvoy, the character is interesting, but I kind of wish it was more animalistic to match the stuff he was doing. It seemed a bit too well-spoken to be the kind of animal it's pretending to be able to climb up walls and constantly like breathing heavily and snarling, and then he starts talking, and you're like, okay, he's not nearly as scary anymore.
It sounded like he was trunk. I still enjoyed it. I think it, in terms of just when he spoke, it was the least interesting to watch of all of his performances, because it was just him trying to sound scary, whereas the others was like he was becoming different people with their own traits, and this was just kind of an I'm scary character. I think it fit what that character was fairly well. It's just, I think the merit of that character is just seeing what he can do, not really, you know, his logic behind anything or hearing him speak.
You have any more positives?
That was the last thing that I had to mention.
All right, so there's there's one thing I really wanted to talk about, because most of the reviews I've watched and listened to for this film criticized the use of the flashbacks throughout the film. Even the people who like love the movie, they say they slow down the story and were unnecessary. And there's something that I noticed on this second viewing that I couldn't disagree more with that interpretation. I think Casey's arc as a character is fully dependent on those flashbacks, not just to get the information that she was molested by her uncle, but also there's the scene when they're all standing together over the dead deer, and the father is talking about kind of the thrill of hunting and why they hunt. There is a close-up shot of the deer's eye, and the couple flashbacks later, it's one of the final flashbacks, one of the final two, after her uncle has abused her and she's threatening him with a shotgun, and you see that close-up on her eye, exactly the same as we saw on the deer, and that is juxtaposed with all of the beasts, all of the people talking about how they're basically the prey of the beast. So essentially what Shyamalan is doing, I think, is when he does that shot of the deer, then the shot of her, he is equating her with being prey, essentially. Her uncle is using her. He's making her his own prey. And in that moment, when she doesn't fight back, when she doesn't shoot him, she submits to him and allows herself to be used by him. And so I think later on throughout the film, we see the couple attempts she does make at resistance up till the last couple of flashbacks were pretty half-hearted. She joins in hesitantly and then stops fairly quickly. And then we see her slowly become more and more bold. And when that final flashback happens, and then we go back to her character, she's just like screaming and weeping. So what I think is that through those flashbacks are her actually remembering her past. And essentially she's working through the past trauma and abuse and coming to the place where finally in the end, she makes the choice to stand up and fight. I think that's the final scene where she's just like screaming is her just deciding no more. I am going to not going to allow this man to make prey of me, to use me. And the end is her making is her character's arc to make the choice to fight, which she has been hesitant to do all along. And honestly, I think whether she had lived or died from that point on, her character's arc would still have been complete. And you see, after she survives and she's in the cop car and they say, your uncle's here to pick you up. And I completely interpret that the look she gives to be that she is going to stand up to him now. She has been through this experience and he will not be able to use her after this, after what she has gone through. And I found that a really fascinating arc, and I thought it was very well told and very subtly told. And I only even noticed it the second time around.
Yeah, there were a couple of things that you mentioned that I did notice. The like with the deer, one of the things that I thought, you know, was just very especially tragic. Obviously, everything in the flashbacks is tragic, but even when she has the shotgun turned on her uncle, when we zoom in and there's clearly a parallel being made between the deer's eyes and her eyes, even with a shotgun in hand, she was the victim. You know, even if she killed him, she was still the victim. The arc that the flashbacks allow the present day version of her character to go on, I think the flashbacks are necessary for her arc to really be meaningful. I have my own criticisms of the flashbacks, but they're not necessarily with the content of what is in it, because I thought that the flashbacks themselves were all done very well and as a whole are necessary for her character to work as a whole.
Mm-hmm. And so I guess that comes to one of the more controversial parts of this film is, alongside that, is the fact that her character was sexually molested by her uncle probably multiple times over a period of maybe 8 to 10 years. And essentially the payoff for that part outside of her character growth is that as she is fighting the beast in the end and her shirt is torn. And then we see she's kind of covered in these scars where she has cut herself. And essentially the beast sees them and says, she is pure, because he's essentially he's kind of a cult leader with these other characters, with the other two personalities, essentially, where his beliefs are the damaged and broken are pure, and they are the whole ones, and the ones who have lived soft lives and never suffered are useless. They're worthless because they have nothing to offer the world because they haven't been damaged and purified. And so the payoff is that when he sees those, he spares her because she is broken like him. And honestly, I don't know what to do with that. I definitely understand the criticism that this might be very clumsy and misguided, but I think Shyamalan's intention was for this to be empowering to people like who have suffered this. I don't know that it was successful, but generally I want to at least give filmmakers the benefit of the doubt. And through the handling, I think he was trying to make this somewhat inspiring. Whether that succeeded or not, I'm not sure. I honestly don't know enough about abuse and how it affects people to really make much of a statement either way. But it definitely did make me a little uncomfortable just how he goes into it and just how it plays out.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand how, you know, he's essentially using that kind of abuse just as a payoff to get her out of the situation in the end. But like you said, I think regardless of how it was handled, I think his intentions were good. I think that's made evident by your interpretation of the last shot of her is the same as mine, where, you know, her eyes look far more determined in that scene than they did prior. So, to me, it was meant to be a message of empowerment. Like, regardless of the fact that this has happened to her, it's not like she is still broken. You know, this is still a part of her past, but she's not going to let it define her and let her continue to be a victim. I think the message itself is a good message, and, you know, I'm sure that people will and have, you know, go back and forth on whether it was handled well or not, and I'm kind of in the same boat as you. I don't know enough about this kind of abuse to feel like I can comfortably make any sort of assessment one way or the other. I only feel like I can make an assessment of Shyamalan's intentions, and I think that they were good, so I myself am not personally bothered with the way he portrayed it because of his intentions and because I thought that for the most part it was handled fairly well.
Yeah, it's essentially kind of our scars and our past pain make us stronger, they make us who we are kind of message. And in the film, I think it's very cohesive and powerful in context of the film, but also he is essentially using what is a very real and very horrific tragedy that occurs, unfortunately, all too often, for what is essentially a very pulpy, dumb horror film. So, I don't know. Yeah. But I do have to, again, I completely disagree. So many reviews criticize the use of the flashbacks, but I think they are not only necessary, not only to show the abuse, but also I think Casey's arc is hinged on them. And I think a lot of people just... It is so subtle. I think the juxtaposition between her and the deer, and then her final choice to fight back, that I think a lot of people missed it, and it's understandable.
So to me, the most glaring issue I had with this movie was some of the editing, especially early in the film, maybe the first third. We have a lot of things going on, and I like that we're not just from the get-go spoon-fed everything that's going on, but it's a lot to try to register. There's a lot of characters that we're being introduced to, a lot of things happening, and we essentially have two plots and a series of flashbacks. You know, we have his meetings with his psychiatrist, Dr. Fletcher. We have the basement scenes with, you know, the girls and their interactions with his different personalities. And then we have the flashbacks to her childhood. And to me, especially early on, some of the scenes are just way too short. They'll only happen, like, I feel like they'll only go on for like a minute or two, and then we cut to something else. And then we cut back, and we cut to a flashback, and then we cut back. To me, I think the film would have felt less jarring and easier to process early on if some of the cuts were just taken away and the scenes were just combined. Like, maybe instead of having a 2-minute scene here and then a 2-minute scene there and then go back for another 2 minute and then go back for another 2 minute, we just have like a 4-minute scene here and then one cut to another. Because, and this may have just been something that bothered me, but it just felt like we were cutting between different plots at a breakneck pace. We were never allowed to stay in one place quite long enough to really get a feel for what was going on in that scene. I don't know if the scenes really did get longer and there were just less jarring cuts later on in the movie, or if I just got used to it. But it was something that kind of took me out of it a little bit early on.
I didn't really notice that. I personally thought I assumed that it was meant to be kind of disconcerting and to the audience, but I thought it felt very cohesive. It's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's not super upsetting. It doesn't ruin the movie by any chance. And I don't even think it's like excessively bad. It's, for whatever reason, for me, it felt like, especially in the beginning, trying to establish what's going on, it would have been more beneficial to let certain scenes breathe a little longer. Because there are a couple moments where we'll cut to a scene and we'll literally only have a handful of lines of dialogue and then we'll cut back. And it just seemed like those lines of dialogue could have just been stitched on to either the end of the previous scene or the beginning of the next one, and it would have felt more natural.
So I guess you could say that the focus of the film's narrative was split.
So if, you know what, if that was intentional, then
I think it is interesting though how it definitely has two distinct stories. It offers way more development to the villain than we usually get, and that makes sense given the context given in the ending.
And perhaps it's just me comparing it to other thrillers, I guess, most recently being 10 Cloverfield Lane, which my personal opinion of that movie is that it has absolute perfect pacing and editing. Every scene of that movie just flows so perfectly that sometimes in this one, I couldn't help but have that in the back of my mind. And so whenever we made some sort of what felt like to me an awkward transition, maybe because it's following on the heels of what I consider almost a perfect movie, it felt a little bit more dramatic.
Yeah, that's understandable. All right, did you have any more dislikes?
So just one last thing. Well, one of these is not really a dislike. It's just mainly more of an observation, but I feel like this movie narrowly avoided being rated R, mainly because of the final act. Like, we've had a psychological thriller for almost the entirety of this film, and then we open the door to this broom closet and there's a girl with her stomach hanging out. Like,
yeah, that was rough.
It got really, really gruesome. And then we actually get to almost see him eat someone else. You know, it's just 2 inches from being on camera, but all the sound is there. It felt very different from everything that had come before. And I think that's intentional. And so I don't fault it for that. But like, and it came out of nowhere. And even I was kind of, you know, it took me by surprise. You know, when he kills Dr. Fletcher by just gripping her and snapping her back, it got very, very dark very quickly.
Yeah.
But I think that makes sense for who the Beast is. So it's not really a criticism. So my last real criticism has to do with the treatment of the other two girls. I think their performances, like I said before, were for the most part fine. They did good jobs with what they were given, but splitting up the characters, I wish that had happened later on, because I wanted to connect with the other two girls more than the movie had me. Because by the end of it, I was fully invested in Anya Taylor-Joy's character, and I wanted to be, maybe not to that extent, but I wanted to feel connected to these other two girls. And for the most part, they did a decent job. Like, it was sad when you find out that they're now dead, but they felt like they were only in this movie as an excuse to get Anya Taylor-Joy's character down there and to show that the Beast is real. Like, mm-hmm. They're only down there because Shyamalan needed, you know, characters that he could kill off just to show what kind of character the Beast was. I just wish that they got more character development, because I really don't know who they are as people by the end of the movie.
Yeah, I think that's where the film's pulpy elements really show up. Yeah, I could agree with that. I think they could have used more development. So I guess the final thing I want to discuss is the possibility that seems to be very open and maybe even probable of having a sequel that joins together this film and Unbreakable. Because we see Bruce Willis's character David Dunn in the end of this movie, and presumably he's going to go hunting after the horde after he drinks his coffee. So, I mean, I love Unbreakable, so the prospect of going into that world again, and I love this movie, so seeing them both together, I mean, seeing David Dunn sparring with the horde just verbally, it really excites me. So I would love to see a sequel. I'm also kind of worried. Do you think Shyamalan's the guy to direct that sequel? Do you even want a sequel?
I absolutely want a sequel. I am very positive on this movie. One, because I think it itself is a good movie, but also because of what I took away from it was that it did almost promise the movie that you're referring to, like this combination of the two. I personally would be very, very disappointed if we didn't get it, because if we don't, then that last scene was essentially just, oh, hey, look, they're in the same universe. Isn't that cool? Like, I mean, yeah, it is cool, but think of the possibilities now. You're going to leave it there? It seems unnecessary if they don't plan on utilizing that connection. And as for Shyamalan directing it, you know, if they keep it fairly low budget, I think he is. I think, you know, he made Unbreakable, and it is a great movie. He made Split, and it's a great movie. He's hot off the heels of two movies that have been considered by many to be returned to form. He seems to be back to where he was. I would say that he's the guy to do it, almost just because he's earned it at this point. He's made both previous films. He's showed that he's still a director. He's constantly talked in interviews ever since Unbreakable that he's had a desire to direct a legitimate sequel. And I actually read an article recently that said an Unbreakable sequel is most likely his next thing to do that he plans on doing. And so I'd take that as that Unbreakable sequel that he's referring to would be this movie that combines these two movies.
Yeah, I walking out of this theater, I wanted to see more. I want to see this, though. I am kind of worried, having just seen Lady in the Water. You would think that the next film in this series would have to be far more traditionally structured. And if there's one thing Shyamalan has proven, is that he doesn't do well with traditional structuring. You look at Lady in the Water, or just straightforward films. I don't think he's great at that. Like Lady in the Water, After Earth, and I haven't seen The Last Airbender, but I'm assuming it was probably a fairly traditional film. That is where he falters. I think he needs to have the tension. He needs to have the gnawing questions in our mind to make his style work. So I there is that worry in the back of my mind that I think I want to see this movie, but I'm also hoping that he finds some way to make it different, because I'm worried that I don't want to see him go back down that sad road he was on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely a valid concern. For me, though, I remember reading in an interview with him, it was after The Last Airbender had come out, and one of the criticisms of that movie was that the movie essentially covered the entire first season of the series, but it was 90 minutes long. So they asked, you know, why was it so short? And his answer was that he's used to directing smaller movies. He's used to directing these thrillers. And so instinctively, he edits for 90 minutes. That's just his instinct. And then after that, he acknowledged that his style was just maybe not suited for those kind of movies. So to me, if he's comfortable acknowledging that more traditional kind of films with more basic movie structures isn't something he excels at, then he might try to find a way to make sure that he can make this next movie unique. Because my worry about if another director took on the sequel would be that it would be more traditional. And I don't know if I want the follow-up to Unbreakable and Split to feel traditional. You know, I think the appeal to both of those movies is that they're so unique. And so if the next one felt like regardless of how good it was, if it felt like just a cool superhero movie, I would be disappointed, because that's not what the first two were. So I hope he directs it just because I'm excited to see how he would change this idea of this previously established superhero and this previously established supervillain meeting, what his take on that would be and how he would make it unique. So it's, to me, M. Night Shyamalan making a good version of that movie would be better than another really good director making a good version of that movie, because his version would probably be a lot more unique and different from other movies we've seen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely hope so.
I just want to talk about how impressive this movie was in terms of the fact that they were able to keep the lid on this. You know, I thought that Abrams being able to, you know, keep 10 Cloverfield Lane a spiritual successor to Cloverfield a secret until 3 months before its release was impressive. Like, that was the feat to beat now. And now Shyamalan comes out and he doesn't even reveal that this is a sequel to a, you know, a very beloved movie that has a cult following. He's able to keep the lid on it being a sequel, not only until its release, but until the very ending of the movie. That's almost unheard of to me.
And what's insane is this film was screened a month ago. They had screenings a month ago. That's what's crazy, is that no jerk in those audiences decided to reveal it. And they didn't even have the muscle of a giant studio threatening lawsuits behind them to keep that going. That's crazy.
I actually heard that, and it was actually from somebody in Popcorn Theology who saw an early screening. He said the Unbreakable bit wasn't at the end of his screening.
Yeah. But it was at some, because I know Chris Stuckman's review, he had seen it like a while back.
That's right.
He was kind of holding on to it. So, yeah, definitely a lot of respect to the guys who held on to that secret for us.
Yeah, I appreciate it, because I don't know if I've ever had a movie experience like that. I've never just sat down in my chair in equal parts shock and equal parts glee.
Yeah, that's basically the perfect description of my thoughts as well. All right, well, I'd like to ask you guys, if you enjoy this podcast, to please go ahead and rate and review us on iTunes. Just a couple words and 5 stars would be hugely appreciated. Also, if you want to follow us, like us on Facebook. That's where we do most of our interaction with you. Feel free to comment or suggest if there's any films you think are underrated that we should review. Also, you can follow us on Twitter. We are there as underrated_pod.
You can also find our website. It's the underrated podcast, podcast.com. And we have an email, theunderratedpodcast@gmail.com.
And so next week we are returning to The Hobbit. We'll be reviewing the Battle of the Five Armies. We will get back to Rite of Fire eventually, but we just have to find a time where we can reschedule it and re-record it. But look on the bright side, at least if you haven't seen it yet, it gives you more time to rewatch it or watch it for the first time. It's definitely worth checking out. Well, we hope you enjoyed this review of Split, and we'll see you later with The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies.
See you.